Because of listeners like you, Preborn has helped to rescue over 67,000 babies. Your $28 to sponsor one ultrasound doubled a baby's chance at life. Your tax-deductible gift saves lives, so please join us in this mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.
AFA Action takes attacks on the family seriously. The enemies of the family constantly employ new tactics to try to sneak past our radar. They know if we stand together, their evil plans will fail. Your gift to AFA Action allows us to stay vigilant against their onslaught. And if you give this month, you'll receive access to the Cultural Institute video, When Your Faith is Illegal, by Frank Harbor on AFA Stream as our thanks. You can make your gift today at afaaction.net.
Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
I love talking about the things of God because of truth and the biblical worldview.
The U.S. Constitution obligates our government to preserve and protect the rights that our founders recognize come from God, our Creator, not our government. I believe that Scripture in the Bible is very clear that God is the one that raised up each of you, and God has allowed us to be brought here to this specific moment in time.
This is Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Good morning. Good morning. It is Tuesday, May 27th, and I hope that you all had not a very happy Memorial Day, as a lot of people do wish, but maybe a solemn Memorial Day, even though it's often a time yesterday where we have a three-day weekend. We celebrate with, the barbecues, the picnics, the pools, all of that. But Memorial Day, I think, is something that we need to, especially in 2025, take a little bit more seriously than just the families who've been personally impacted through loved ones that have given, as Lincoln said, the last full measure of their devotion in service to the United States. So I wanted to take this first segment and talk a little bit about Memorial Day, because across America, when flags are waving at half staff and cemeteries are filled with families and quiet prayers and folded flags, it's not really about the barbecues and the sales and the three-day weekend. It's ultimately about sacrifice and honoring those who have fallen and asking ourselves really a solemn question. What kind of a country were they willing to die for? And is that the same country that we live in today? And the answer to that question, I think, matters, because if their sacrifice was for something sacred, then it is our duty to preserve it, and not just in memory and our tributes and our Instagram posts, but in truth, in law, and also how we live as a people. Because America wasn't born out of a lust for power or conquest. It was born in the belief that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights. And this isn't just a slogan. It's not just something that we can go and read at the National Archives. It's a covenant, really. It's a mandate for the country. It's a bold declaration that government doesn't grant rights. God does. And government exists not to rule over us, but to secure those rights. And so from the hills of Lexington to the fields of Gettysburg, the beaches of Normandy, which I will have former President Ronald Reagan talk about in just a moment, and to the deserts of Afghanistan and elsewhere, our soldiers have died to uphold this promise that America would be a nation under God, governed by law, rooted in liberty, and committed to truth. But the hard truth, really, that we need to contemplate today is this. If we lose the meaning of America and it just becomes this collective of people who come together in a great melting pot, who don't have any culture, don't have any real purpose except celebrating our diversity, then do we actually dishonor the memory of those who died defending something greater? So we have to ask, where are we now? What are we as an American people? Are we still a nation where freedom of religion is protected, or one where people of faith are silenced? Are we still a land that respects life and liberty, or one where children are taught to hate their country before they can even spell it? I mean, are we a people who still believe in sacrifice and duty, or one addicted to comfort and afraid to speak the truth? Because the Apostle Paul wrote to Timothy, no one serving as a soldier gets entangled in civilian affairs, but rather tries to please his commanding officer. That's 2 Timothy 2:4. Our military understands that, but does our culture understand who our true highest authority is? Not just our commander in chief, not just our political party, not whether we're a Trump Republican or the flailing Democrats, but who is our real commander? Scripture also tells us, and I saw this posted, including on my own social media a lot yesterday, John 15:13. Scripture tells us, greater love has no one than this, than to lay down one's life for one's friends. And that's the kind of love our fallen heroes have shown to America. It is really a Christ-like love. It's a selfless love. And it's a love that says that your life and the future of this nation matters more than my sacrifice. That is the foundation of both our faith and our freedom. And yet today, how often do we treat freedom as a license for sin and not a gift to do good? How often do we use our liberty to divide rather than unite? So the founders gave us a republic, but only, as Benjamin Franklin warned, if you can keep it. But what does it mean to keep it? Memorial Day, I think, is not just about remembering the past and honoring it, but about choosing what our future will be, and will we be a people worthy of their sacrifice? So I want to play for you now the full speech from Ronald Reagan, and this was actually given on the 40th anniversary of the Normandy invasion, and this was years ago. I mean, this was the year of my birth in 1984, so this is a while ago. And consider how differently Ronald Reagan thinks about America. And this speech is so famous, but you may have never even heard the whole thing, or it may have been a really long time since you heard the full about 13 minutes. But consider what he's saying about America and about that future. And now, 40 years later, are we honoring this vision of America? I mean, almost 250 years later, after our nation's founding, are we still honoring that mandate and that covenant to be a people worthy of freedom and understanding the rights that God gave us and understanding government's obligation? So listen to this.
We're here to mark that day in history when the Allied armies joined in battle to reclaim this continent to liberty. For four long years, much of Europe had been under a terrible shadow. Free nations had fallen. Jews cried out in the camps. Millions cried out for liberation. Europe was enslaved and the world prayed for its rescue. Here in Normandy, the rescue began. Here the Allies stood and fought against tyranny in a giant undertaking unparalleled in human history. We stand on a lonely, windswept point on the northern shore of France. The air is soft, but 40 years ago at this moment, the air was dense with smoke and the cries of men, and the air was filled with the crack of rifle fire and the roar of cannon. At dawn on the morning of the 6th of June, 1944, 225 Rangers jumped off the British landing craft and ran to the bottom of these cliffs. Their mission was one of the most difficult and daring of the invasion, to climb these sheer and desolate cliffs and take out the enemy guns. The Allies had been told that some of the mightiest of these guns were here, and they would be trained on the beaches to stop the Allied advance. The Rangers looked up and saw the enemy soldiers at the edge of the cliffs shooting down at them with machine guns and throwing grenades, and the American Rangers began to climb. They shot rope ladders over the face of these cliffs and began to pull themselves up. When one Ranger fell, another would take his place. When one rope was cut, a Ranger would grab another and begin his climb again. They climbed, shot back, and held their footing. Soon, one by one, the Rangers pulled themselves over the top, and in seizing the firm land at the top of these cliffs, they began to seize back the continent of Europe. 225 came here. After 2 days of fighting, only 90 could still bear arms. And behind me is a memorial that symbolizes the Ranger daggers that were thrust into the top of these cliffs. And before me are the men who put them there. These are the boys of Puente Hope. These are the men who took the cliffs. These are the champions who helped free a continent. And these are the heroes who helped end a war. Gentlemen, I look at you and I think of the words of Stephen Spender's poem. You were men who in your, quote, lives fought for life and left the vivid air signed with your honor. I think I know what you may be thinking right now, thinking we were just part of a bigger effort. Everyone was brave that day. Well, everyone was. Do you remember the story of Bill Millen of the 51st Highlanders? 40 years ago today, British troops were pinned down near a bridge waiting desperately for help. Suddenly they heard the sound of bagpipes, and some thought they were dreaming. Well, they weren't. They looked up and saw Bill Millen with his bagpipes leading the reinforcements and ignoring the smack of the bullets into the ground around him. Lord Lovett was with him, Lord Lovett of Scotland, who calmly announced when he got to the bridge, "Sorry, I'm a few minutes late," as if he'd been delayed by a traffic jam, when in truth he'd just come from the bloody fighting on Sword Beach, which he and his men had just taken. There was the impossible valor of the Poles, who threw themselves between the enemy and the rest of Europe as the invasion took hold, and the unsurpassed courage of the Canadians, who had already seen the horrors of war on this coast. They knew what awaited them there, but they would not be deterred. And once they hit Juno Beach, they never looked back. All of these men were part of a roll call of honor with names that spoke of a pride as bright as the colors they bore. The Royal Winnipeg Rifles, Poland's 24th Lancers, the Royal Scots Fusiliers, the Screaming Eagles, the Yeomen of England's Armored Divisions, the Forces of Free France, the Coast Guard's Matchbox Fleet, and you, the American Rangers. 40 summers have passed since the battle that you fought here. You were young the day you took these cliffs. Some of you were hardly more than boys with the deepest joys of life before you. Yet you risked everything here. Why? Why did you do it? Well, what impelled you to put aside the instinct for self-preservation and risk your lives to take these cliffs? What inspired all the men of the armies that met here? We look at you and somehow we know the answer. It was faith and belief. It was loyalty and love. The men of Normandy had faith that what they were doing was right, faith that they fought for all humanity, faith that a just God would grant them mercy on this beachhead or on the next. It was the deep knowledge, and pray God we have not lost it, that there is a profound moral difference between the use of force for liberation and the use of force for conquest. You were here to liberate, not to conquer, and so you and those others did not doubt your cause, and you were right not to doubt. You all knew that some things are worth dying for. One's country is worth dying for, and democracy is worth dying for because it's the most deeply honorable form of government ever devised by man. All of you loved liberty. All of you were willing to fight tyranny, and you knew the people of your countries were behind you. The Americans who fought here that morning knew word of the invasion was spreading through the darkness back home. They fought, or felt in their hearts, though they couldn't know in fact, that in Georgia they were filling the churches at 4 a.m. In Kansas, they were kneeling on their porches and praying. And in Philadelphia, they were ringing the Liberty Bell. Something else helped the men of D-Day: their rock-hard belief that Providence would have a great hand in the events that would unfold here, that God was an ally in this great cause. And so, the night before the invasion, when Colonel Wolverton asked his parachute troops to kneel with him in prayer, he told them, "Do not bow your heads, but look up, so you can see God and ask his blessing in what we are about to do." Also that night, General Matthew Ridgway on his cot, listening in the darkness for the promise God made to Joshua, "I will not fail thee nor forsake thee." These are the things that impelled them. These are the things that shaped the unity of the Allies. When the war was over, there were lives to be rebuilt and governments to be returned to the people. There were nations to be reborn. Above all, there was a new peace to be assured. These were huge and daunting tasks, but the Allies summoned strength from the faith, belief, loyalty, and love of those who fell here. They rebuilt a new Europe together. There was first a great reconciliation among those who had been enemies, all of whom had suffered so greatly. The United States did its part, creating the Marshall Plan to help rebuild our allies and our former enemies. The Marshall Plan led to the Atlantic Alliance, a great alliance that serves to this day as our shield for freedom, for prosperity, and for peace. In spite of our great efforts and successes, not all that followed the end of the war was happy or planned. Some liberated countries were lost. The great sadness of this loss echoes down to our own time in the streets of Warsaw, Prague, and East Berlin. The Soviet troops that came to the center of this continent did not leave when peace came. They're still there, uninvited, unwanted, unyielding, almost 40 years after the war. Because of this, Allied forces still stand on this continent. Today, as 40 years ago, our armies are here for only one purpose: to protect and defend democracy. The only territories we hold are memorials like this one and graveyards where our heroes rest. We in America have learned bitter lessons from two world wars. It is better to be here ready to protect the peace than to take blind shelter across the sea, rushing to respond only after freedom is lost. We've learned that isolationism never was and never will be an acceptable response to tyrannical governments with an expansionist intent. But we try always to be prepared for peace, prepared to deter aggression, prepared to negotiate the reduction of arms, and yes, prepared to reach out again in the spirit of reconciliation. In truth, there is no reconciliation we would welcome more than a reconciliation with the Soviet Union, so together we can lessen the risks of war now and forever. It's fitting to remember here the great losses also suffered by the Russian people during World War II. 20 million perished, a terrible price that testifies to all the world the necessity of ending war. I tell you from my heart that we in the United States do not want war. We want to wipe from the face of the earth the terrible weapons that man now has in his hands. And I tell you, we are ready to seize that beachhead. We look for some sign from the Soviet Union that they are willing to move forward, that they share our desire and love for peace, and that they will give up the ways of conquest. There must be a changing there that will allow us to turn our hope into action. We will pray forever that someday that changing will come. But for now, particularly today, it is good and fitting to renew our commitment to each other, to our freedom, and to the alliance that protects it. We're bound today by what bound us 40 years ago, the same loyalties, traditions, and beliefs. We're bound by reality. The strength of America's allies is vital to the United States, and the American security guarantee is essential to the continued freedom of Europe's democracies. We were with you then, we're with you now. Your hopes are our hopes, and your destiny is our destiny. Here in this place, where the West held together, let us make a vow to our dead. Let us show them by our actions that we understand what they died for. Let our actions say to them the words for which Matthew Ridgway listened: "I will not fail thee nor forsake thee." Strengthened by their courage, heartened by their value, and borne by their memory, let us continue to stand for the ideals for which they lived and died. Thank you very much, and God bless you all.
That was, of course, former President Ronald Reagan, and it is a sobering reminder today, even 40 years later, what are we striving for in this nation, and can we say the same about our loyalties and our cause today? And I think it's a great question as we honor those who have given the last full measure of their devotion. We'll be right back with more here on Jenna Ellis in the Morning.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. And as we're talking about the future of freedom and liberty in this country, we are looking at my home state of Florida as the beacon of what a state should be, or at least that's what we've said for the last few years in Florida. But what exactly is going on in this state? And are we still the champions for liberty and freedom under the state legislature that we at least have been under the Governor DeSantis administration? That's a great question. And Florida lawmakers, while the original session ended on May 2nd, they did vote to extend the regular session to June 6th in order to complete the budget and several other related items. So where are we at in the free state of Florida overall? Let's welcome in Senator Jay Collins. And good morning, Senator. So where do you want to start in Florida?
Well, Jenna, first off, thank you for having me on here. And you had me all fired up listening to the GOAT, Ronald Reagan. It was absolutely incredible. What a moving, poignant, focused speech. It was just incredible to hear that. So thanks for sharing that, first off. But yeah, man, why don't we jump right into the budget? I think that's a pretty big step right now. Sound good?
Yeah, absolutely. And where are we at with Florida, with the budget and property tax? I mean, there's so much that's going on that I think actually kind of reflects some of the priorities or maybe lack of priorities on the federal level as well with the budget.
Yeah. So currently where we're at in terms of the budget is you nailed it on the head. June 6th is the next cutoff. Ultimately, we've got to get out there, get a budget signed, or we're going to have to make a decision. Our decisions will be to continue to extend the session or to just stop it and put it in the hands of the governor or, you know, the speaker and the Senate president to call a special session. And ultimately, I'm kind of in the mindset that I'm not a fan of the extension. I think we got to take all the policy off the table. And by closing the session out, bring the special session, you just focus on the budget. It's the one thing we have to do by July 1st. Our people expect more from us. We have to get this right. We have to lead. It's been a critical issue for us right now.
Yeah. And so where is the Republican supermajority on this, and why do we even need these extensions?
Well, this has been a unique session, I think is the best way to say it. You've got
that's nice.
Between the House.
That's nice, Senator.
Yeah,
it's been
unique. My matters. It's Tuesday morning. You know, the House and the Senate have been kind of offline. And frankly, this goes back to the immigration thing that we started the session with. You know, there were three of us, myself, Blazin Golia, and John Martin, that stood in the Senate initially, and a couple people in the House. And a few more joined in towards the end, but that really set a tone for this year. And I'm so glad we did. That immigration stance ensured that we had the most proactive and aggressive immigration policy of any state. And if you look at what other states are doing compared to Florida to support the federal government and what the president's doing, we're leading the way, as people should expect. And unfortunately, that's continued on. You've seen a lot of bills being chopped up. You've seen a lot of open arguing between the governor and the speaker. And I'm proud to say that the Senate right now is doing what we're supposed to do. We're the upper chamber. We're working with the governor. We're focused wholly on getting this budget passed. Now, I do want to say there's been some good news. The sales tax discussion is off the board. That was pulled off from what we've been had explained to us. So that's a good thing. Overwhelmingly, people want property tax relief, not sales tax relief, because really, that primarily goes to those who are visiting our great state of Florida. But, you know, again, I want to reiterate that we've got to get this done. Florida expects better. We have to lead on this issue. And what we've been doing just isn't quite good enough yet.
And I'm speaking with Senator Jay Collins out of the great state of Florida. And you know, you mentioned this kind of tension with the legislature and that it's been a very unique and interesting session. And part of this has also been because of Florida's need, really, to have bold conservative leadership for the future. And the, of course, upcoming gubernatorial election that will be next year. And there's already, I think, a lot of tension between Republicans as to who the nominee should be. Of course, you know, Trump has already endorsed Representative Byron Donalds, congressman from Florida. There are a lot of my friends here in Florida and conservatives who are very skeptical of that potential nomination and would like to see someone else who is perhaps more of a bold conservative come into the mix. But with this, instead of just directly confronting some of these issues, Senator, there's been this huge smear campaign against Hope Florida. And and I'd like you to go into that just a little bit. And for listeners who want to read more about this, my opinion piece on American Family News this week was actually on this. So you can read this at AFN.net. And the title is Smear Campaign Against Hope Florida and the Truth DeSantis's Critics Don't Want You to Hear. So I go into detail about all of this. But I think the political point of this, Senator, is that a lot of people are focusing on a smear campaign just to destroy Governor DeSantis's legacy and maybe turn from someone he would endorse to a Byron Donalds, who a lot of people aren't looking in Florida, aren't looking toward as that bold, courageous leader.
Yeah, Jen, I think you've hit a lot of key points on the head there. But let's unpack Hope Florida. I am a vocal advocate for it, and I can tell you exactly why. Look, I grew up without two wooden nickels to rub together. I grew up in a very economically challenged family, to put it nicely. We grew up with alcohol and drugs around us. And, you know, my grandparents adopted me. Without them doing that, I don't know where my life ends up. We grew up on commodity cheese. We grew up on government welfare. So I know the effect of that. I know the cost of that. But I also understand the opposite of that. Hope Florida is a level up for what government should be. It's a public-private partnership, the government working by, with, and through local organizations to solve real problems. You know, go back to September 24, Centene really got into what's called a civil settlement agreement. And from that, there were two specific deposits, one of $57.25 million, which went to the state, and one that was $10 million. And here's the critical fact. It's a donation to Hope Florida. And that's pretty common if you look at the Centene situation. One of the things I've heard asked is, why is there no case number? Well, it didn't go to court. It was settled. So there is no case number, first off. People have asked about the grants. What about the two $5 million grants? The fact is, those went to nonprofits under the missions of Hope Florida, very specifically. And they went through a very focused approach. These weren't just given willy-nilly. There is a set process that was done to make sure that the money was being appropriated and used for the right reasons. You know, it's unfortunate to see this. Having a nonprofit and working in the disaster space, I've seen exactly what Hope Florida can do. I will tell you, we've passed people all over the state to them. While we've been feeding people, you know, things that were far outside of my scope, and Hope Florida always stepped up. They always solved the problem. And look, sometimes any nonprofit has to recalibrate and solve a little problem here and there, but they've always come back along and made sure that nobody fell behind. And I'm so proud to see what Casey does. I'm so proud to see what Hope Florida does. And I think that takes us to that bold conservative leadership mindset that you've been talking about. You know, that's what Florida demands.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, what's really frustrating, I think, about this scandal, and for those of you who maybe are outside of Florida politics and you're kind of just seeing this, you know, a little bit, this is really the left-wing media, but aided by, unfortunately, a few Florida Republican legislators that are either eager for headlines or, you know, some kind of other motivation. They've really tried to manufacture a scandal where none exists. And so this is all about a $10 million, you mentioned that settlement, but Medicaid funds that were quote unquote diverted into a charitable foundation somehow tied to the governor's office. That claim has been flatly debunked, not even just by conservative media or DeSantis's office, but even by like Politico and other outlets that, you know, are no fans of conservatives. And so why do you think, Senator, that this particular narrative that has been debunked has been championed even by some Republicans in the legislature instead of looking forward to conservative leadership that Florida needs to continue to pave the way for other states to follow? I mean, why this controversy?
Well, it's all about 26, right? It's all about the future of the state and where this thing goes. And it's discrediting Hope Florida and the DeSantis brand. That's what this is supposed to do. And the fact is, people see through this. Average Floridians see through this. They've seen the good that it does. But, you know, we got to keep aggressive on this. We have to be out here banning the pulpit and explaining exactly what this is, why it happened. And I'm so grateful for you standing alongside the governor and so many others on this. It's politically motivated. This isn't politics. Nothing about Hope Florida is about politics. It's about people. It's taking care of our people. Floridians, moms, dads, people who need a hand up, not a welfare handout for eternity. This levels up, changes the future of the families, and makes a concrete difference in terms of getting people off welfare. It'll save hundreds of millions and billions over time. I actually believe we need to expand this and have this be the kinetic capability for all nonprofit function within our state. I think there's a lot that can be done. Imagine a government that rather than funneling money directly to, you know, people to keep them from work, actually connects them to resources, helps them solve problems, and gets them off of that government dependence. It's incredible to see what we can do when we stop relying on the government to solve our problems. Hope Florida is an incredible solution. And I hope and pray that it's around for a long time because it's going to change lives.
Yeah, but, I agree. I agree. I mean, it's a coordinated effort across several state agencies to connect people in need with resources that promote self-sufficiency instead of dependency on the government. I mean, this is a program that, independent totally of politics, is a very good thing that Republicans and conservatives should champion. And yet it's in the crosshairs of all of this controversy just because some in the Florida legislature would like to weigh in a false way for the leadership in 2026. And so as we look forward to the next gubernatorial election and who will follow, in my opinion, the GOAT of Florida, you know, the Governor DeSantis and his leadership, where are we at with that? And for Floridians and for the rest of the country that looks to Florida as the state that is leading the way, the free state of Florida, it's the blueprint. Where are we at?
So, you know, you hit the nail on the head. You've got to walk in the shoes of the greatest of all time, a governor who led through COVID, a governor who has shifted the future of this state just by sheer willpower, grit, determination. You know, it's courage, candor, commitment. That's a big thing to overcome. You've also got to walk in the shadow of a federal government and President Donald J. Trump, who is larger than life, his shadow cast across the world. Many of the things that he has in his agenda, we proved right here in Florida. I often look to Florida as the conservative proving grounds of America. We did it first, and now we need to expand that out across the nation, because when Florida leads, America wins. We've proven that over and over. So what do we need going into 26? Well, I'll tell you, there are no races over. There is nothing done. You know, the people of Florida want someone who is going to step up and lead, who's going to focus on real issues, who's not going to back down and just toe the party line. When something doesn't make sense, you've got to use your voice. You've got to lead on the issues. If you want to earn the trust of Floridians, it's a little bit like Sparta, right? That we've said it on the show a few times. This is Sparta. Well, this is Florida. We do things a little differently. Our expectations are incredibly high coming off of what will be 8 years of Governor Ron DeSantis. And, you know, there's a lot of time left. We'll see what happens. All I know is whoever steps up, better be prepared to lead from day one, better be prepared to solve real problems. You know, we've got to step into this property tax thing. We have to continue to work on insurance. We have to continue to solve transportation and other focused issues. And we sure as heck can't let off of our ability to support our church, to support our communities, to stand up for 2A rights. You know, that is something we lag behind on, and Governor DeSantis has been incredibly bold on. You know, we have to remember who we are, where we came from, because the future that Ron DeSantis has painted for us is incredible. You just got to have someone who steps up to the plate.
Yeah, so well said, Senator Jay Collins, and you can follow him at Jay Collins FL for Florida. We need someone who will be as bold in leadership as Governor DeSantis. And so could that be a Senator Collins, potentially?
Well, Jenna, I don't know. I think there's a lot of cart before the horse here. It's amazing to hear people just throw my name out there, but in the end, it doesn't matter who it is. It's got to be someone that the governor gets behind, that our people get behind, and that lives up to the expectations of Florida. That's really it. And, you know, I can speak for myself. I can speak for many people I've spoken to because they've shared this. This isn't about Team DeSantis or Team Trump. This is about Team America and Team Florida. You know, you heard the GOAT, the best president of all time, Ronald Reagan, talk about ideas, ideals, and values. Those are the things that Americans and Floridians want to hear, man. We are one state, almost 24 million people, a thriving economy. We lead in education. We lead in real issues. And we're just getting started.
Amen to that. And we got to take a break here, Senator Collins, but so well said that it's not about Team Trump, Team DeSantis, Republican, you know, anything. This is about moving forward for freedom and liberty for Florida and ultimately for America. We'll be right back with more. When a woman experiences an unplanned pregnancy, she often feels alone and afraid. So many times, her first response is to seek out an abortion. But because of the generosity of listeners like you, that search may lead her to a Preborn Network clinic. Preborn offers God's love and compassion to hurting women and then provides a free ultrasound to introduce them to the life growing inside her. This combination brings the ultimate miracle of life to life and doubles a baby's chance at life, which is why Preborn saw over 67,000 babies rescued last year alone. Meet Maddie. Maddie was in a tough situation as she wasn't sure who the father of her child was. But after receiving counseling, prayer, and a free ultrasound at a Preborn Network clinic, everything changed. Maddie discovered she had twins and found the strength she needed to choose life. Your tax-deductible donation of $28 sponsors one ultrasound. How many babies can you save? Please donate your best gift today. Just dial #250 and say the keyword baby. That's #250 baby, or go to preborn.com/AFR. That's preborn.com/AFR.
Welcome back to Jenna Ellis in the Morning on American Family Radio.
Welcome back. Well, we've been talking about the principles of freedom and liberty and the principles that should undergird the conservatives and the Republican Party that is supposed to be at least the conservative party and our ideals that have framed the past founding of America and also should frame the future. But what about the future of the progressive wing of not only America, but also the globalists and the World Economic Forum and, of course, you know, the flailing Democrats? They don't really have as much principle as maybe they have double standards. I always like to say if the Democrats didn't have double standards, they wouldn't have any standards at all. But we know that they're not going anywhere, right? I mean, this isn't just, okay, Trump won, and so the Democrats are going to pack up and go home, and the leftists and all of the woke DEI nonsense is just going to say, we tried, we failed. So there's a brand new book out that is titled The Heir, the inside the not-so-secret network of Alex Soros. So the George Soros empire is now the Alex Soros empire, and the son is more radical than the father, according to Matt Palumbo, who is the author, and he joins us now. So, Matt, I think this is a very timely book because we're seeing that the Democrat Party really doesn't have a leader or a cohesive message, doesn't really have anything, but we still have major figures like George Soros and now Alex Soros, as he's the heir of the empire, that is going to be shaping the progressive left for probably the next few decades.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on. And, you know, I put Not So Secret Network in the title as opposed to the prior book about George, which was Secret Network, because Alex just loves to flout, to sort of advertise his influence as if he's bragging. And historically, he has networked with really just the Democrat elite, Chuck Schumer, Nancy Pelosi, Hakeem Jeffries, etc. But we do get sort of an indication on what he thinks the future of the party will be just from his Instagram profile. And I kid you not, he posted a photo recently with Jasmine Crockett and said that she's going to be the future of the party. So, you know, he is actually pretty bad at politics, in my opinion. He was very, very heavily backing Joe Biden after the first debate, and only debate, obviously. He was making all of these excuses about why, no, it's fine, we should keep him in. He predicted about a week or two before Biden dropped out that he would never drop out. Then Kamala Harris takes over. He predicts up to Election Day she'll win every swing state. Obviously, you know, we know how that goes. And then right after the election, writes some essay about how, you know, we really should have known all along that Trump would have won this thing. So he doesn't have very much political acumen, fortunately.
well, that's maybe a good thing that we can predict based on his lack of predictions. But unfortunately, he has the money and the influence to have a lot of political influence. And so what will the future of Alex Soros potentially look like?
So far from my research, it seems like he is going to use climate change as a sort of catch-all issue, because what the left does is and you see this at every left-wing protest, they will be a focus of the protest. So let's just say climate change in this analogy. But you go to the protest, you know, not us literally, but if you went to one, you'd see also, you know, a guy who's pro-union, a pro-minimum wage guy, a pro-Palestine guy, like every liberal cause, they're all the same people. They just sort of swap out the lead issue is. So for him, it's climate change. And my friend Joe Vasquez and I at the Media Research Center went through all of the climate-related grants at the Open Society Foundation. So it's 3 months to go through. And we were going to track, you know, what has climate spending done before and after Alex took over? And in all the years leading up to Alex taking over, which was 2016 to 2022, it was about $190 million in climate-related spending by the Soros empire. In just since 2023, when Alex took over, they've announced over $400 million in climate-related grants and things. And the thing is, it's not really just climate. It's climate is the face. And, you know, there are groups like the Sunrise Institute, which are claims to be pro-climate, but they're the people blocking off highways, but then also disrupting pro-Israel events. And they just use climate as the face. So it's really just a continuation of what his father is doing. He's just changing his lead issue. And climate is, ever since he's been quoted publicly over a decade ago, that seems to be the issue he's obsessed with. And I'll probably elaborate a bit later about his White House visits and how that ties in. But yeah, that's mainly his thing. He's a climate warrior. He's the Greta Thunberg of the Soros family, I suppose.
And I'm speaking with Matt Palumbo, and his book is titled The Heir, Inside the Not-So-Secret Network of Alex Soros, and it's out for pre-order now on Amazon. It'll be released in December, but I encourage you to go and pre-order this now. You're going to want to read it. So the book, again, is titled The Heir. And I'm glad, Matt, that you said, you know, that climate change is just kind of the new face of an issue that really is just almost a facade for the work that the progressive left is continuing to do, because it seems like climate change is sort of a a non-issue at this point, at least for where the party is going. Why would Alex Soros choose that issue? I mean, I know it's popular, you know, with some of the younger generation still, but it seems like that has been a favorite and a not really great winning issue for the left.
Someone remarked that they're like watermelons. They're green on the outside and red on the inside, and I think that's really a perfect way of describing them. I mean, if I had to think like a climate warrior or someone who's at least pretending to be one, the brilliance of the climate change issue is you're never wrong in that, you know, the famous prediction from the UN of, oh, we've got a decade left to live. You can go back to the 1970s, and they were saying the same thing. They just, or if you look at back at the first Earth Day, the predictions of what was going to happen by today, they're all apocalyptic. And all they do is then say, well, okay, we were off by 50 years. And you just push it back and back and back. And, you know, it appeals to a certain level of hysteria that I think is much more common naturally in the liberal brain. I think their brains are probably just more prone to that kind of thinking in the first place than ours. So it's just a perfect issue. And it also appeals to people who are almost attention-seeking or want to view themselves as godlike. And we see that with Greta Thunberg, where when she was in the news for climate, that's all she was in there for. And then once Palestine started taking media attention away, she's putting on a kiefa and going protesting for that. The issue was almost secondary to the gratification she wanted to get, although I think Alex is obviously much more politically motivated than, ego-motivated like his father.
And you mentioned as well that Alex Soros is propping up Jasmine Crockett, which is just laughable to any reasonable person. But at the same time, I mean, she's the loudest, maybe, and the most brash of the Democrats. And so why wouldn't they prop her up? Is that really the future of what the Democrats think, you know, is going to actually influence their party? I mean, it seems like they really aren't cohesive with any sort of message other than just being loud and obstinate.
Yeah, and I think propping up Jasmine Crockett is a sign of that. I mean, all she does is get headlines, and obviously we're in a different bubble than they are, but it seems like all the headlines she's getting from are negative or to our benefit. I don't see how any normal person can see how she behaves and thinks that it's normal. But if they genuinely do think that she is the face of the party, it is too, you know, just a sign. They have no idea what they're doing, what they stand for. I mean, I don't know if you saw recently, you must have, they're going to invest $20 million to try to figure out how to appeal to men. And I'm thinking, just look in a mirror and do the opposite. That's free. But no, they have no idea what they're doing.
And I'm speaking with Matt Palumbo, and again, the book is The Air, and you can get it for pre-order at Amazon now. And so, you know, as you mentioned, this isn't the end of Soros-backed radicalism. This is just kind of the new face. This is the next part of this. And so do conservatives see this and see where Alex Soros may be investing, you know, his time and energy and substantial wealth? And do we have a strategy to fight back against the next era of radicalism? It is laughable, right, that, you know, he's propping up Jasmine Crockett, all of this stuff. But this also is serious because there are serious political influence that this kind of capital can buy.
Well, yes, and like his father, it's the local races are where he's having a lot of success. And we just saw that in Wisconsin where he went to bat with Elon Musk. And obviously, there were a lot of other left-wing donors in the race as well, but that left-wing judge that Alex backed did win. He's also had a lot of success in continuing the funding of the rogue district attorneys. And in researching for the book, and I have no idea how I missed this earlier, but in 2022, Alex actually took over the PAC that was funding these DAs. So anytime you see a Soros DA in the news that was elected 2022 onward, it actually wasn't George. It was Alex behind that. And there was one in Harris County, Texas, where the incumbent Kim Ogg was backed by George Soros back in the day. She ended up sort of reneging on her promises to implement a lot of these weekend crime policies because she put a few into place. They backfired, and then she wised up and kind of turned on the Soros agenda. So Alex Soros then ran his own DA to primary the George Soros DA and won. So we're at a stage, not only is Alex Soros running DAs, he's running DAs to unseat George Soros DAs for not being crazy enough.
Wow. That is just taking the lawfare and the emphasis on a very corrupt judiciary that, you know, is the Soros brand to kind of a whole new level. And so, you know, again, in just the last couple of minutes I have with you, Matt Palumbo, and again, the book is The Heir, pre-order it at Amazon now. What are conservatives doing, particularly with fighting this kind of hostile takeover of the judiciary?
I mean, unfortunately, it seems like really not enough. You know, I think that, you know, someone like Elon Musk really is the best position to go after these people. I mean, not like I'm trying to talk myself into a job, but I would, you know, love to provide him with a list of the people he's going after. Media Research Center does a lot of tracking on this. They have their own database. And, you know, I think even if he alone was just bringing attention to it, because obviously he is the biggest platform in the world, that would help. I did see recently he said he was going to kind of pull back from politics, but, you know, hopefully he'll change his mind there. You know, to any, I guess, right-wing donors, I know generally speaking, or at least historically, they seem to focus more mainly on, you know, fiscal or economic causes. And I just think that at this exact point in time, this is far more important.
Yeah, so well said. Well, again, the book is The Heir. The author is Matt Palumbo. And you can reach me and my team, Jenna, at AFR.net.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Preborn's whole mission is to rescue babies from abortion and lead their families to Christ. Last year, Preborn's network of clinics saw 8,900 mothers come to Christ. Please join us in this life-saving mission. To donate, go to preborn.com/AFR.